So learning to focus the mind to the attitude of acceptance, relaxing into accepting rather than controlling and resisting, going against all the kind of conditioned reactions and habits in the world. You see why a spiritual path is considered one of the more difficult things to develop, because many people who are very successful in the world have the greatest problems with the spiritual life, because you can't just clever mind and powerful abilities to control, manipulate the conditions or your mind or situations are not of any use in the spiritual life. But it's not a kind of wishy-washy, just kind of resignation or giving in to things, but being able to admit, to be able to be patient, and especially this faith in this ability to witness and observe, because in this particular way we're observing the arising and ceasing, the changingness of conditionality as you're experiencing it. It's not as from your body, from what you see, hear, smell, taste, touch, think. All mental conditions. So we can use the six ayatanas, one way of reflecting on the six groups of the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body and mind. The five khandhas, the rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara, vijnana. But these are convenient teachings to contemplate, groups that we're using, categories, in order to notice, to pay attention to impermanence. And of course, what's most easiest to see is the impermanence of thought or emotion, or just the object, just how sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, and are fleeting experiences. And then mental experience, the conditions of the mind. But that which is aware, the Buddha, or that refuge in the Buddha, that's the constant factor in this practice. The changing conditions, we're observing the changing, the rising, the ceasing. But that which is observing doesn't have a quality or a characteristic. So we call it refuge in the Buddha. It's awakenness. And then the people inevitably ask, well, what is it that really sees? You want to find out, who am I really? What is my true nature? And this desire to know things about things is so strong that the problem isn't in knowing who you are. It's we're knowing what you're looking at, what you are not. You're not the body, not the feelings, not the perceptions, not the mental formations, not consciousness. What's left? Well, you can't find yourself, can you? Because you don't need to. That's it. Just ability to you don't need to know who you are. Because the problem isn't with that, it's that you believe you're all kinds of things you're not. So we endlessly suffer over about what we think we are. But it's a tricky business because we inevitably want to hold on to something. And this is like the faith, or this like they call it like jumping off the 100-foot pole in the Zen tradition, or leaping into the abyss, or into the unknown, into the black hole, into these other frightening images of going into something dark and unknown. Because you say the desire mind wants to make sure everything's going to be all right. I'll leap off the cliff, or I'm sure there's a safety net to catch me. Now, when the mind is kind of empty and clear, and it's the essential teaching of the Buddha is the Four Noble Truths. So this teaching is something to contemplate and investigate. So if you want something to do, contemplate these Four Noble Truths. And of course, this is like the First Noble Truth: there is dukkha, or suffering. And dukkha is a Pali word which means that which we can't bear, or it can be unsatisfactory. Sometimes the suffering is just the using the word suffering sometimes can give the wrong impression of it just being some kind of miserable state. But dukkha also can be applied to just the unsatisfactoriness of happiness, because happiness is a temporary state, isn't it? It's not satisfying in itself. It's pleasurable, but it's not dependable, because it's dependent on so many other things. To be happy, you have to have things going right. You have to be feeling well, and so forth. So that happiness, we're not being kind of like sour grapes and saying happiness is suffering, is a put down of happiness. But we're noting that happiness is an experience. It's a temporary experience. And when you just want happiness in life, you're busy trying to find it or get more of it. So people do, you know, much of the modern hedonistic approach to life is to endlessly go from one happy thing to another, one pleasurable experience into another, and in the process, one gets burnt out or bored or depressed, because it's tiresome to always be looking for happiness. So happiness is even though. In America, we say the right to happiness. We have a right to it. I don't think the British have a right to happiness. Americans do. And happiness is still, even if you have the right to it, it's still an unsatisfactory experience. So dukkha is to be understood. And so we notice when we... the important way of phrasing of Buddhist teachings, because in many cases it's badly presented and misunderstood. Like in comparative religious studies or something, they'll say Buddhists believe that everything is suffering. The Buddha taught that everything is suffering. And then the Christians will say, but Jesus taught, and then Jesus, of course, says something more inspiring than that. So one way of putting us down But that's not the right, and that's a misunderstanding. It's not a categorical statement in the terms of a premise that you start with. Or it's not metaphysical statement, you know, like saying everything is suffering, starting from a belief, from a grasping of that view that everything is suffering. But it's a mere statement, a reflective statement, there is suffering. So when you're trying to put Buddhism into kind of a metaphysical position, a philosophical or categorical statement that you can say explains Buddhism. If you say everything is suffering, that's not what is meant, because the First Noble Truth is more of a pointing at an experience, not a categorical statement. So then apply this to yourself. Like if you say, if you notice you're suffering, and then usually you'd say, I'm suffering right now. I'm so unhappy. Life is miserable, and I'm depressed, and I don't feel very well anymore. I'm suffering. Is how we generally talk when we're suffering. We usually say, I am suffering. But a more effective way of doing it and reflecting is there when you feel this suffering, experience of suffering, you say, there is suffering. Because the sense of I and suffering is strongly, you know, if you start with I'm suffering, it sounds, you know, you have a whole way of thinking about yourself that's very highly conditioned. And so you end up thinking, I don't want to suffer anymore. But when you're using this more reflective approach, and you say, when you're feeling miserable, unhappy, or uncertain, or anxious, or whatever, there is this. So it's a pointing, it's getting you to look at something that you're feeling, or a mood, or a sensation, or something, or an experience that you're having. You're admitting it, but you're not putting it in the usual frame of reference of it being my suffering, or I am somebody who's suffering. But it is pointing, it helps you to reflect on the actual experience of suffering. Then suffering should be understood. So in the Four Noble Truths, you have three aspects of each noble truth. So the first is a statement, there is suffering. The second aspect of the First Noble Truth is what you should do about it. So you say, suffering should be understood. So understanding suffering is the second insight. There's 12 insights into the Four Noble Truths. So there's Four Noble Truths, three aspects of each truth, which make 12 insights. A very neat package. But if you can't follow that, just recognize that the first of all, the First Noble Truth, the statement, there is suffering. The Second Noble Truth, there is the cause of suffering. Third Noble Truth, there is the cessation of suffering. Fourth Noble Truth, there is the way of non-suffering. There's the path, the Eightfold Path, which is the way of non-suffering. So you notice there's the statement of the problem there is, and its causes, and the way to let it cease, and the realization of its absence, and then the path or the way of living your life where you're not creating suffering into the remainder of your life. So it's taking just this ordinary experience of suffering, and that everybody experiences suffering. So it's the most common. It's the bond amongst all human beings, isn't it? In Thailand, and oftentimes monks will say, brothers and sisters in old age, sickness and death and suffering. Because we're all, I mean, it's a common experience, whether, you know, no matter what race, nationality or whatever, it's a bond. We all, this is the most, this is something that we can understand, human suffering. So to understand it means, like, it doesn't mean to kind of define it in an abstract way or rationalize it, but to go to it. What is, if I'm suffering right now, what is it? Understanding it means to go right into it, feel it, stand under it, or, like I use this word, embracing it, totally accepting the feeling or the mood or the way it is. So if you're, you know, if you don't understand suffering, then you tend to merely, as soon as you start suffering, you want to get rid of it. You react to it. So the tendency is always, as soon as you feel unhappy or pain or anything that is unpleasant, then you just, how can I get rid of it? You know, change it, distract yourself, take some kind of medicine, do something to get away from it. But notice this advice is to understand it, stand under it, or really admit it, notice it, so that you embrace it, feel it, which is going against the reactive tendency to try to run away or find happiness and get rid of suffering. And then the second insight is this should business. You should understand it. And then through practicing understanding the suffering, then you have the third insight is suffering has been understood. So there's a statement of the problem itself, the prescription, and the result of taking the medicine. And then the second noble truth is there is a beginning or origin of suffering, which is the grasping of desire. So the second noble truth points to the desire, the nature of desire. And desire in Pali is dunha, Which there's three kinds of dunha that they list. You can put desire in three categories, like sense desire. Desire for sense pleasures is one obvious kind. Desire for beautiful objects or good food, this kind of desire. Sense desire. And then there's the desire to become something. I want to become enlightened. I want to become successful. I want to become happy person. I want to become a wealthy person. I want to become someone who's respected. It's all me. I want to become something. What I am right now is not good enough, and I want to become. So much of our even meditation is based on becoming. I want to become enlightened. And I'm not good enough the way I am. You know, I've got a lot of problems, weaknesses, faults. I'm coming here so that I can learn how to meditate, so I can become somebody enlightened sometime in the future. Maybe. Is it possible, Ajahn Sumedho, for me to get enlightened? Well, it's hard work, you know, you've got to put a lot of effort into it, and it takes years. Hard slog. And someone like you so then maybe I can't become enlightened, or I, you know, some people will say, well, maybe this lifetime it's beyond your hope, but you can maybe by living a moral life, you can be reborn in a higher place. you can become a devata or an angel in the next after you die. That sounds rather nice. desire to become a devata in the next life. Or sometimes the idea in Thailand oftentimes is that if you're generous, then you get reborn. You're reborn as a beautiful looking person. So in Thailand, where they've got a lot of good-looking people, they are very generous people, so I think it's true. That must work. But yet being born good-looking also is not the answer, is it? To still suffering to be good-looking. So, I mean, this is not a satisfactory goal, as far as I'm concerned. It's a very attractive possibility. But so this desire for becoming, bhava-danha, you can see it in yourself. Just notice all this kind of ambitiousness, or this wanting to get something you don't have, like a mental state, become something, achieve something, attain something. And so you're contemplating these desires, like desire for, like sexual desire is quite obvious, isn't it? Or desire for beautiful things, objects, or sense objects that are pleasing, and the desire for them is quite an obvious experience. But becoming, sometimes we don't see that as desire. Because in the worldly sense, it's right to become a success, want to become a better person, wanting to become something, a rich person, wanting to become successful, wanting to become someone who's respected, and all this is normal behavior in worldly values. But this is an emphasis that's worth investigating, just to notice what desire is. And then the third kind of desire is called vipavadanna, which means a desire to get rid of, desire to destroy, deny, get rid of things. So there's I would tend to be a very vipavadanna type person. As they before I when I ordained as a monk, I'm more inclined towards annihilation than towards eternal happiness. The idea of going into oblivion is more an attractive possibility than being happy forever. And some people would rather be happy forever and find annihilation threatening, but I mean, these are different tendencies of different people, but the idea of living in heaven for eternity as me, as a person, I can't imagine anything worse than that. It'd be another hell. You'd have to be a human, this kind of a separate entity for eternity, happy all the time. But oblivion sounds, just to not exist is sounds all right. I don't mind just not, disappearing into a void. But there's still the desire, isn't it? The desire to get rid of, to not exist. And so this is, or desire to get rid of things, desire to get rid of bad thoughts, desire to get rid of anger and greed, desire to get rid of sleepiness and dullness, and desire to get rid of doubts and worries and restlessness. Desire to get rid of is a very strong kind of desire. It also has a kind of righteous quality to it. Desire to get rid of bad things seems like the right thing to do, isn't it? Desire to get rid of all evil. We should get rid of evil. So Vipawadanha oftentimes has a lot of wicked things are done out of Vipawadanha in the world. Kill the witches, burn the heretics and so forth, get rid of your enemies, to destroy and get rid of what you don't like. So notice this in your own, this desire to get rid of. Now, desire then is an energy. You can be with awareness, mindfulness, you can observe desire as an object. It's always looking for something. It's always moving towards something. It's always trying to get something or become something or get rid of something. So when you identify with desire, then you think you are the desires. But actually, with mindfulness, isn't it, you can observe desire. That which is aware can see desire as a mental object. So desire can't see desire. One desire can't see another desire. But that which is not desire can see, knows desire as desire. So this is why your refuge in the Buddhist phraseology is in the Buddha. So the Buddha knows the way it is. So desire is then seen and recognized. So with desire, you have to study it. You know, feel it, know it, experience desire. So, but in the way of investigating it, so you really, it has no way of deluding your mind anymore. So we're not coming from the idea you should get rid of all your desires. Because sometimes people think of Buddhists that we're all here, you know, determined to get rid of our desires, monks, nuns, and we're all here to get rid of sexual desire, get rid of greed and all these bad desires. We're attacking them all the time, trying to get rid of them. That's not what we're doing. We're studying, we're knowing, we're understanding, we're feeling these desires. We're in this idea of investigating, looking into, insight into. So you know it. You know what it is. You know you feel it. As soon as if you really understand desire, as soon as there is desire, you know what it is immediately. Because it can't delude you anymore. Because if you're just trying desperately to get rid of desires, you're always going to fail. So you feel, I can't meditate, I can't, you know, I'm so full of desires, it's just hopeless. You give up and feel despair. But if you, we're not coming from the place of denial or extermination, because this is a desire realm we're living in. The body is a desire body, isn't it? It's a sexual body. It has sexual drive. These are natural drives. The desire, this is a desire realm, desire for becoming, annihilation and procreation and so forth. So this is desire is natural to this realm. We wouldn't have been born into it if we hadn't any desires. This is the result of desire. So we're studying the desire and looking at desire and investigating desire so that you can know, because desire is not self. So when you see desire and really and see that the grasping of desire is the cause of suffering, not desire but the grasping of desire. And this is a very important emphasis in Buddhism. It's the emphasis, because like the body is a desire body and all these things are just, you know, this is a desire realm, so it's not kind of putting it down as something that shouldn't exist. This is what we This is what we're experiencing in consciousness, all these desires, the pulls, the changing conditions. I mean, when you see something you like, you want it, you know, you're attracted to it. See something beautiful and you feel pulled towards the beauty, or you see something ugly and you feel repelled by it. That's natural. That's not like personal neuroses or anything wrong with you. It's just the natural movement in this realm of attraction, aversion, and desire. But notice in your refuge, you're transcending the desire realm, which isn't meaning you're destroying it. It means you're able to see it as a mental object. So that's why mindfulness is the way. This pure state of ontological transparent awareness. How's that one? Sustained ontological transparent awareness. I don't think I can manage that one. I think I'll become a Jehovah's Witness. So then the insight into desire is that because there is this grasping of desire, then the insight is to let go, letting go of desire. So with the second noble truth, the insight is the letting go of things. So to let go of desire, you've got to recognize, admit it, desires like this. You're feeling it, you know it, you're attached to it, you know what attachment to desire is, suffering. You're not just believing these things because the books say so, but you're actually, you know, feeling it, realizing it yourself. So then the insight is letting go of desire. And then the third insight into the Noble Truth is the second. Insight is desire should be let go of, and then the third is the realization. And when you actually practice, put it into practice, you actually let go of desire, there's the awareness of desire has been let go of. So notice that like suffering and desire, attachment, the conditioned realm, all this, pointing to experience in the present, ordinary human experience in the present moment. Nothing's kind of mystical or you know, outside anyone's direct experience in the present. But it is this awakenedness, isn't it? It's this awareness we're using, or watching, and we're using wisdom. You're using wisdom and mindfulness as to inform your conscious experience, because we're conscious beings. So that consciousness is we're experiencing consciousness, which means we're experiencing life from this point here. From this position, yeah, I'm experiencing. You're in my mind right now. Do you realize that? You know, as far as actual at this moment, I'm looking at you. You're in the mind. You see, that's because this is a conscious formation that can, and so the mind isn't just. I don't mean that you're up in the brain or anything like that. But we're pointing to that this is more like a radio or some kind of instrument that picks up these things. So we can, like sight and sound, smell, taste, touch, thought, and all that are functions in consciousness, but these are mere kind of vehicles or instruments, but they're not like permanent souls or selves. Or when we identify, when we kind of fully identify with the instrument, it's just not the way it really is. So when we're you know, if you think you're a radio, you know, you can be a bit, you think you're really, that person's really, you know, got it all wrong. But we do think we are the body. Then the third noble truth is there is the cessation of suffering, or the ceasing of dukkha or desire. And in this, the desire and dukkha are synonymous. And you can use dhanha or dukkha. And so when you let go of desire, and you're aware of it, because desire is an object, you're aware of its presence. As you study it, you realize what grasping desire is like, that it's suffering. You let go. Just like grasping fire, isn't it? You realize it hurts, you let go of it. You aren't going to hold on to it anymore once you realize that the grasping fire hurts. So then you let go of the fire. And then you realize what it's like not to be grasping something painful and hurting you. Letting go has been realized, and then there is a cessation of suffering. So the suffering ceases, and you realize the absence of suffering. So just to say, applying that to then the insight into the third noble truth is suffering, the cessation should be realized. So this word realization is a very interesting word, because it's something, you know, it's the reality of things. To realize cessation means that the desire is ceased, and you're aware of it, the absence of it, the reality of non-desire is like this. So in this, with mindfulness, a sustained awareness, and so forth, you're beginning to get a feeling for the practice of nibbana. The word nibbana or nirvana means realizing non-attachment. So in the Mahayana school, they say, They give these kind of enigmatic paradoxes, like samsara and nibbana, and nibbana and samsara, and so forth. Like nibbana, in Theravada, oftentimes you get into these kind of very doctrinal attitudes. Nibbana is almost kind of, you know, has nothing more to do with samsara. It gets to kind of polarized. But as actual experience, you'll find like samsara is that when you're in the world and you're attached and then as soon as there's awareness and you let go, there's a realization of nibbana. Or nibbana is you're still experiencing the same phenomenon, but you're no longer attached to it. So say there's a desire and you're attached, that's samsara. There's a desire and you're not attached, is nibbana. Realization of nibbana. So desire might be, maybe a desire arises in your mind, but when you know it and you don't attach to it, then you don't get pulled into the samsara. As soon as you attach to it, then you become that desire. So like whatever you attach to, you become that way. That's what like rebirth is in terms of experience, isn't it? Somebody insults you, and you feel, and somebody says insults you, and you feel the vipaka kamma of this insult, you feel this, this feeling arises. There's awareness. If you attach to the feeling, then you become somebody who's offended and angry at being insulted. If you don't grasp it, then there's awareness of the feeling itself, but you don't grasp it. So even though the vipaka kamma, or the resultant karma, might be that we live on this planet and we've made lots of karma with each other, and people say things and all that, and they affect us. So when somebody insults me, I can still feel it. I know what's happening. It doesn't feel nice. You know, somebody says some nasty thing to me, it's not like I'm oblivious or don't feel it. But I know what's happening, so I don't grasp it. Train myself not to grasp that feeling or that which has arisen in the present. So in this way, you're not making more karma with this condition. Where if somebody insults me, and then I grasp that feeling, how dare you talk to me like that, and all that, then I'm making karma with it. I become somebody who's insulted, you hurt my feelings, I'm indignant. Or maybe I'm just saying, I'm just trying to deny it. I'm just saying, I don't feel anything, I don't care what people think. I must forgive them anyway. Person is obviously suffering, has problems of his own, and of course, you know, I feel compassion. But it's still, you're making karma with it, aren't you? You're identifying with it, and you want to punch him in the nose, or you're trying desperately to be this noble, all-forgiving person. But it's still karmic. There's still attachment to it. But when there is this recognition of it for what it is, then there's no, you don't attach. So the realization of Nirodha or of Nibbana, of non-attachment. But you might still feel. You know, that's why it's in the. With Dhamma, you're observing what it's like to be conscious and have feelings and all that and perceptions, but you're no longer identifying, clinging to these five khandhas, rupa, vedana, sanya, sankhara, vijnana. So then, cessation has been realized, then the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path is the way of non-suffering, or way of not creating suffering, onto the vipaka of your life. So, I was born, so now I'm 62-year-old person. The result of being born is that you get old. If you don't die young. So 62 is the result of birth. And if I'm attached to the idea of I'm 62 years old, then. But if I recognize that this is just the natural result of birth, a human body being born, living 62 years, this is the result. It's still 62-year-old body and all that, but there's no non-attachment to it, non-identity. So you don't create suffering around being 62 years old. If I'm attached to the idea that I'm somebody who's 62 years old, then and say I don't like to be that, I want to. I mean, I like people to maybe if I'm vain, I think. Somebody says, you don't look 62, I just admit it. I could easily pass for 35. And I, that's what I want to hear. That's because I'm attached to the that being 62 is suffering, and I don't like it. But if it's not self, if it's just the way it is, then it doesn't matter. You know, it's just the vipaka kamma of birth. Or, you know, I've living in a community, or here in Britain for 20 years, and then living in with the monks and the nuns. There's certain karmic things, so that you get the vipaka of it. So, like, I'm an upachara, meaning I can ordain monks and nuns. So I give them ordinations. So then you give them, you know, that's like they get ordained. As, then the vipaka of it is that they disrobe. So if you're attached to the idea of them, you know, of just ordaining, and then and without, you know, then and you're, you, this is what you want them, you know, you're the desire for them to stay as monks and nuns, and then they disrobe, then you can suffer when they disrobe. But if you're aware of all this, then you still feel it when they disrobe. It doesn't, when a monk or nun disrobes, I've never felt happy and joyful. And it's not a feeling like when somebody disrobes and you're really happy about it. There's always a sense of, you know, the vipaka of it that I feel is a kind of grief, or that of when somebody leaves the sangha. So I mean it, but that's the vipaka kamma, rather than which I can not grasp. When I'm mindful, I don't grasp the vipaka kamma that arises in the present. But that doesn't mean I don't feel anything when somebody disrobes. You know, you see, don't feel a thing. I'm so advanced now. Nothing touches me, nothing affects me. Somebody calls me an obscene name and I don't even feel it. I don't even know what they mean. I'm so pure. All those nasty words, I've completely lost my memory of what they mean. It's not like amnesia or senility. When somebody you love dies, I remember when my mother died about 8 years ago, and I thought, you know, I went. My father died 8 months previous to my mother, and then went to California to see my mother, and then I was with her for about a week, and then I went off to teach a retreat up in San Francisco, and she was in San Diego. And then the day after I left, my sister and my mother took me to the airport and said goodbye, and then the next morning my sister phoned and said my mother died. And so that, what is that, just the, on a telephone, your sister says your mother's died, you get a certain feeling. I couldn't understand what she was saying, or that I didn't feel it. It feels this way when, because I loved my mother, so the loss of, the sense of mother dying was like this. You could feel it, you know, aware of that feeling. But there's, it was an acceptance and a willingness to feel it too. It wasn't, I shouldn't feel like that, but or a resistance or a rejection, but it was a willingness to feel loss as a natural experience. And so I had to start that very evening giving a retreat, a 10-day retreat, which was about the last thing I wanted to do, you know. But there was no one else who could do it. No other people wanted to, were counting on this retreat. So I had to kind of make myself teach, which I could do. You know, I can gather, you know, consider the circumstances and rise to the occasion. And then in the middle of the retreat, I had to fly down to the funeral in San Diego. But being aware of all that was happening to me. I mean, there was the feeling and the actual funeral and the burial and so forth was definitely a part of the practice. And one was, but there was a willingness to feel it and be with it. But at that time, I was still very much examining the feeling of grief and really looking into it and really accepting the feeling of grief. And so that was where I was at then. And it was interesting with Lungpo Cha's death, and then last June, Master Xuan Hua, of another monk I had great respect for, he died in California. So I went to Master Hua's funeral last July. I had to fly from here, this is during our rains retreat season. I could only go for 7 nights. Ajahn Sujito and Sister Sangamita and I, we flew to California, attended the funeral. And just when we meditated we could see, they had him in a coffin and you could see his face. And so I was meditating on the face of Master Hua. I was just observing, you know, just watching this experience of the grief would come when I'd think Master Hua is dead. And then, you know, I was looking, my eyes were visually seeing his dead face, which looked quite nice, you know, it was quite, wasn't like an unpleasant sight. But I was looking at his face, and then the thought, Master Hua is dead. And that kind of thinking would bring this feeling of grief. And then I practiced going from thinking into the silence of the mind, and then there's no grief. It's like letting go of grief. But it wasn't suppressing it. It wasn't like trying to get rid of grief. But it was just the ability to observe the difference between how thought does affect us when we think, and we're with these thoughts and we're feeling the thoughts. And this, then Master Hua is dead, feels like this. And then shifting into the silence of the mind, the pure awareness, without thought, then I felt a kind of joyfulness. Because with Master Hua is different. Well, the karma with Master Hua is very different from the karma with my mother. And with Master Hua, he was more or less a symbol for the higher teaching, for truth and selflessness. So that, you know, that just being able to, in the silence of the mind, in that purity, realize that actually is just the condition dying, ending, you know, that what one really loved and that wasn't, doesn't die. You know, the body of Master Hua and the person of Master Hua and all that dead. But actually, because my relationship with him was based on monastic life and on meditation practice, then it was very clear the kind of joy and of realizing what is really true is deathless. What is truly beautiful and that is deathless. So you can see it's a way beyond transcending grief itself. But notice what I'm saying. I'm not saying that you're getting rid of grief. One needs to really understand these feelings that we have, the way things are. Because it's not, we're not trying to just not feel grief, not feel anger, not feel anything, but be able to use these very experiences in the vipaka kamma of our lives for understanding and for letting go, for realization of the path, of the way of non-suffering, or the Eightfold Path. So the Eightfold Path then has the right understanding, because this understanding is that you have, that you have, say, from contemplating the Three Noble Truths, the first Three Noble Truths. The suffering, its cause, cessation. Then there's a perfect understanding there of it. And from that comes an intention, what you intend, your attitude goes toward doing good and refraining from doing bad, because you still have a life to live as a human entity, so your intention then is to, say, live a moral life. To, like, right action, right speech, right livelihood. So the eight folds of the Eightfold Path are the right understanding, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood. So that deals with your physical existence, how you're going to live, use your body and speech for the rest of your life. And then right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration, you know, the last three. So the last three folds. So right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration is mental, isn't it? It's the effort, there's an, you know, the right amount of effort to live your life, and balanced with mindfulness as a kind of middle point where you're aware of effort and concentration. So these are the fold of the path. They work together. They support each other. It's not like a linear progression, but more of a rising together in a moment of the path as a way of living and relating, responding to the experiences that we have in the present. But then it's coming from wisdom and right understanding. So then there's a spontaneity ability to learn and to live life in a way that is of great benefit to oneself and all other beings. Because we're all interconnected, interdependent. So these Four Noble Truths, is a teaching that say I've used for 30 years now, but it's really, really kind of taking those four truths and just studying and investigating and watching and listening and experimenting and learning from it. The Four Noble Truths is the Buddha's first sermon after his enlightenment. when he was, after he was enlightened, then he, in fact, the story goes, he was enlightened, sitting under the Bodhi tree, and the first thought that came to his mind after enlightenment was, this is so subtle, nobody's going to understand it. There is a kind of reticence, maybe, to think, you know, there's a feeling of, because it's such an imminent realization, you think no one can understand it. And then, as the god Brahma Sahampati comes, one of the Brahma gods, and says, "Please, please, for the welfare of those with only a little dust in their eyes, teach the Dhamma." And so. So this is in the language of mythology and legend, but anyway, then the Buddha saying, "Well, who can I recall now that would probably understand, that might be able to understand?" And so he thought of various teachers, and then through his psychic powers, he realized they were dead, and then he remembered these five friends he had that had deserted him, and. So he decided he was going to go see these five friends. And so he went off from Bodh Gaya to what is now Saranath, there near Benares, walked there. And on the way, he met another ascetic. And this ascetic said, you have this radiant quality. What is it that you've realized? And the Buddha says, I have realized perfect enlightenment. I have nothing more to do. I'm completely free from all delusions. The ascetic looks at him and, well. And walks off in the other direction. So then he goes to the deer park in Benares, and the friends who had kind of deserted him, thinking that he was getting soft, because they were all very strict, hardline ascetics. And they saw him coming, and here comes that soft man, that weakling. And they said, maybe, you know, when you're a hardcore ascetic, you really despise people who eat milk rice or delicious things. You see us eating ice cream, you just feel disgust. Give us nettle soup every day. Then they eventually say something changed about Gotama. What is it? What did you realize? So then the Buddha gave his first sermon, which is the Four Noble Truths, the suffering, its causes, cessation, power. Now that was the skillful means he used in which he taught, which he established that what we now regard as Buddhism, the teaching of the Dhamma, was established on those Four Noble Truths. And it was very interesting to experiment with it, because I've been a monk for a long time and use that, you know, how that particular teaching I find just something that really, you know, it's not like you kind of study it your first year and then you don't need it anymore, but it's actually, you know, you're applying it, those realizations and that are very profound. So it's a teaching it's not an intellectual teaching, but it's a formula to use for reflecting on experience. So these are, you know, they're insight, they're something, they're not just kind of abstract ideas or theories, Buddhist theories, but you know them for yourself, like the taste of honey. If you taste honey, then you know what its flavor is. If you don't taste honey, that you can't possibly know really what it tastes like, even with the best descriptions. And the Dhamma, if you taste the Dhamma, then you really know yourself what the flavor of it is. And therefore you don't need all kinds of descriptions about it. You actually know it yourself. It's an insight knowledge. Where much of our life is based on belief in what somebody says or tells us. But this practice is for this going right into it and realizing the truth and realizing the deathless. Now notice that this teaching is about the realization of deathlessness, of transcending the death-bound condition. So in this way, it's not just a kind of psychological, worldly psychological teaching, but it is a transcendent teaching. It's a proper religion. That's what religion does. Its aim of religions too is pointing towards the transcendent, towards the deathless. Humanism might point towards, you know, being a good guy and not having setting up a utopian community with a good economic system, political system, social system, you know, that earth-bound and planetary proper ecological management of the planet in a perfect society. It would be a kind of humanistic approach. But as a religion its aim is to connect to the transcendent or the divine again, so that it's pointing at that, toward the deathless. And so the Buddha Dhamma is that kind of a teaching. It's a practical way of investigating experience to get beyond the delusions we have around the body and the conditioning of your mind. So, it's a Four Noble Truths teaching.